Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Salman Rushdie, the author most recently of The Ground Beneath Her Feet, published by Holt. The last book was The Moor's Last Sigh. He's the author as well of India's Children and many other novels. I'm particularly delighted because this book delighted me, and I have so many questions to ask about it that I'll get started right away. To begin with, the book seems to want to make a composite mythology between Indian legend and Greek legend. And, of course, it's facing some of the difficulties of doing that in that previous attempts have led to justifications for Nazism and the like. Could you speak about that?
Yeah, I mean, I've always had an interest not unlike the interest of the character in the novel, Sir Darius, who is the father of the hero, Omus Kama, an interest in comparative mythology, because it is interesting to me that the kind of great story stock of Indian and Western culture actually seems to have come from the same root, with all kinds of interesting local variations. And so I've been just reading in that sea of stories for as long as I can remember. And of course, the terrible thing that you mentioned that happened was that the word Aryan, which was only ever used by scholars to mean a language root, was then used by Hitler to build a kind of master race theory, and it polluted the field of Indo-European studies for more than a generation, really. But now, happily, people can get back to the pure study of these beautiful stories and to show their similarities. So that, for instance, I had become interested in the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, not just the love story, but the form of the descent into the underworld and so on. And it was very interesting to me that in the Indian version, or the closest Indian version of that myth, it happened the other way around. That's to say that it was the woman who rescued the man, right? Because in the Indian version, the love god Kama, as in who's my hero is called Omus Kama, which is a fairly obvious connection, but Kama as in Kama Sutra, I guess. Kama, the love god, decides to play a trick on the great god Shiva and to shoot an arrow into his heart and make him fall in love with some unsuitable wench, you know. And Shiva, being Shiva, sees the arrow coming and deflects the arrow and then, in rage, unleashes a thunderbolt at Kama and basically fries him, reduces him to ash. And it's his wife, Rati, who has to plead with Shiva to let him come back to life, which eventually Shiva does. And so you have the Indian version of the story shows that the woman literally brings love itself back to life. And I thought that reversion, that reversal of the Orpheus story was not just interesting ethnologically, but also gave me a clue about how to write this book.
Well, what's glorious about it is that although the mythology has played a role in all of these books, here the trio of heroes and become, in a sense, gods and goddesses, and their stories not only replay but take their place among the mythic stories. And so there's a feeling that this particular triangle is being spotlit, in a sense, by mythic literature and history. As a result, these characters seem both larger and more human than any of the others of yours that I know.
Oh, well, thank you. I hope to obviously have something like that effect. And that's to say, to write something which is set very much in the real world. I mean, it's set, after all, that's to say, if you can call rock and roll the real world. whatever close approximation to the real world that is. But then, as you say, to shine on the life of the characters, the light of this this ancient body of stories, and to show how we're part of that flow, you know, was obviously also part of the intention. Yeah.
Well, in addition to being surrounded by mythology, a good swath of the literature they grew up with, ranging from Clockwork Orange to a covert reference to the Crying of Lot 49, the works, a Joseph Heller type has written Catch 18, and they are very much of their time, but they're in a parallel time, and I wanted very much to talk about that. Our first intimation of that is that the hero, Ormus, the musician and composer, sees different worlds, one from each eye. One of them he's being led through, a kind of Las Vegas hell, by his dead twin brother. And it seems as if in that world we are experiencing a variant of the world that Ormus lives in. Mm-hmm. Could you explain?
Well, partly because in my own life, I mean, I at a certain point made the decision to live in the West, not in the East, and was always conscious of that other self, you know, that I might have been had I taken the other road. And I think it's one reason why so many shadow selves and parallel selves, and in this case, parallel worlds, you know, grow up in my writing, that I've always been conscious of another possibility that might have been me. You know, so that was one, if you like, personal source of this idea. Another was simply that I was doing in this book a rather crazy thing, or I was making a crazy proposition, which is that the biggest stars in the history of rock and roll music came from Bombay in India. And as anybody who's ever listened to this music will know, that's not true. And I thought, well, if I'm going to try and get away with that, then let it not be the only such outrageous proposition in the book. You know, let this, since I'm obviously then saying this is a very fictive idea, you know, that the story that is being told is a story that couldn't have happened and didn't happen, but I'm going to insist that it did and try and make you believe that it did. Well, that's of course just what we call fiction. You know, I thought let's just make that world an overtly imagined world, and so I shifted other things.
Now, the most extraordinary inversion that goes on, and although it occurs at the end, it resonates throughout. The whole book is leading there. This story of Orpheus doesn't involve a man taking his wife out of hell. It involves a wife taking a man into hell.
Mm-hmm.
And the sense is that in each of these parallel variant worlds, each is a version of hell to the others. In other words, ultimately, where we are, wherever we are, is a variant of hell, which seems to be where this book ultimately is taking place. Music is the only road, it seems, out of hell. Love is another. Usually they're co-joint.
Yeah, it's kind of, I think you're right. I think you're exactly right. I think the book does have, I mean, if you like, a tragic sense of life, you know, of which another way of putting it is that life is hell.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a tragedy written in the form of a comedy. You know,
as always,
which I've always thought to be the only thing to do, you know, to laugh in the face of it. But yes, I mean, I think that, for instance, the New York in the novel is, you could see in one sense as being a descent into an inferno, but I hope in another sense is also fun. You know, I mean, I've always thought that hell would be more fun than the other place, while continuing to be hell.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope the book has something of that flavor. But, I mean, I didn't want to take the Orpheus story and then just literally adapt it to a 20th century setting, because, I think that would have been boring for me, and I think probably boring for you. You know? And I wanted to use it as a starting point, as a way of thinking about love and music and death and et cetera, and then, but then bounce off it into ideas of my own. And you're right. I mean, for a start, I wasn't planning to write a ghost story. You know, so the idea that Eurydice, or you know, that the woman would actually arise from the grave in some literal way, some kind of haunting way, you know, it was obviously never going to happen. So, yes, so exactly that when Vina dies, which it's giving away nothing to say because her death
she
is
dies in the beginning.
Yes, she dies in the first sentence. You know, she in some sense takes almost with her that his in this book his obsession with her beyond the grave, which is also Orpheus's obsession, in a way drags him down into a kind of living death, you know, and it created a rather interesting difficulty in the book for me, which is that given that these are the two main characters, that at that point in the novel where there's still about 150 pages of the book to go, you know, one of the main characters is dead, and the other one is very withdrawn, at least, you know. And at that point, when writing a first draft, I discovered that finally the third point of the triangle, the narrator, the photographer Rai, who spent the whole novel really as a kind of semi-voyeuristic devotee of them both, you know, waiting desperately for it to be his turn with Vina, and it went well. It occasionally is because she's that kind of girl, but it never seems to matter to her quite as much as to him. But suddenly I realized that at this moment when she had gone and when Ormus had more or less absented himself and retreated into this huge white space on the Upper West Side, looking out over Central Park, but doing more or less nothing, that it was finally going to be Rai's turn, and that he really became, in that last movement of the novel, the central character. And actually, you know, got the girl, I mean, not Vina, but the girl who then enters the story.
It seems as if the novel is written on a kind of spiral pattern. That is to say, it begins in Bombay, and we follow the lives of the parents of the three heroes. And then it begins again as the book passes through a membrane, and we hear the stories of the heroes themselves. And part of the design of the book seems to be to ask what would happen if people in some way could be freed from their parents, because there's an enormous amount of plot gadgetry around the breaking up and the severing of families and the forming of new units. Why? It seems more so than in any of the books. These parents eat their children in your work, but here especially.
Well, first of all, in a book that's at least partly about various forms of secular half-gods, you know, I mean, e.g., for example, rock stars, I wanted to start with if you like, the first superstars of our lives, which are our mothers and fathers, you know? And as Rai, the narrator, says at one point in India, for many people, our parents are like gods. Our parents are as gods, and so the world of the parents, the first world that we scrutinize with the kind of obsessive interest, you know, with which later some of us peruse People magazine. Was interesting to me for that reason. It became a counterweight to the religion of celebrity, if you like, that happens later in the book. But also it's a book about breaking away. It's a book about how family ties in the end don't bind, you know, and how the story that we're supposed to be in, the story of the continuum of our lives, which goes from our parents through us to our children, you know, can be a rift in that. There can be a sudden interruption in that, you know, and our modern lives can arise out of that interruption. You know? So yes, there's a lot of violence done to family in the early part of the book, to the idea of family, in order to set people free from it. And one thing that Rai says at one point, which I think is sort of true in many cases, is that we leave home in part to avoid the sight of our parents running out of steam. You know, and so that as these gods crumble, you know, we have to go away and make our own lives. And that's what happens here.
I'm speaking to Salman Rushdie about his new novel, The Ground Beneath Her Feet, published by Holt. You're listening to Bookworm, and this is Michael Silverblatt. Now, this would seem, if I can interpret, your vision of this the latter half of this century. And the longer novels do seem to follow in chronological order from the beginning of the century to the present day. You seem to be suggesting, both structurally in the novel and in terms of an analysis of culture, that we're living in a rift culture, that between the age of the parents and the age of the children, the ground opened up. The figure for this in the book, in the literal sense, is earthquakes splitting the earth open, but on the metaphysical level and the level of art, it seems to be a rift in vision between our world and something called other world, a place where the rules of art seem to have more coherent use than the rules of cause and effect. And I wondered if you would talk about rifts, because it seems to have to do with Vico as well.
Yes, certainly the ideas of Vico, of which Joyce made a lot of use. You know, I stole a few of them myself. I suppose what happened is that I found myself having set out, as I said, thinking about forking paths. You know, about realities fissuring into infinite alternatives. I found myself thinking about the opposite of that, about what would happen if realities came into collision with each other. And then I thought that, yes, of course, that led fairly naturally to earthquakes and so on, to worlds in collision, and it led in the novel to all kinds of visions of instability, you know, of provisionality, of the idea that we live in a world in which literally we can't take for granted the ground we stand on, and which can be pulled out, you know, the rug can be pulled out, you know, at any minute, and home and family and love and place and even life, you know, can become uncertain just at the point at which we relax into thinking of them as comfortable. And I think that is part of the vision of the book. But then at a kind of larger level, which I wanted not to didactically underscore in the book, but I think is there, is the idea that I think we do live in a time in which there are realities violently in collision, you know, and they can't both survive. And I think that's one way, for instance, of talking about the war in Yugoslavia, that you have radically incompatible descriptions of the world, you know, the Milosevic description, the Albanian description, in violent conflict, and they can't, and something's got to give. You know, only one of them can survive. And I think if you look at recent events, at, if you like, the post-Cold War world, you know, you see this everywhere, right? It's as if in the Cold War you had these two very big incompatible descriptions of reality, which was, you know, the world according to the West and the world according to the Soviet Union. And thank goodness they somehow stayed in a state of equilibrium and didn't lead to a general conflagration, you know, sometimes more by luck than judgment. But since the disintegration of that uneasy equilibrium, it seems as if we have lots and lots of petty realities, you know, clashing often fatally, lethally with each other. And that, if you like, bigger historical political vision, you know, well, made sense of the book in some way for me. Now, I didn't want to point too many allegorical or current affairs fingers, you know, in the book, but just to leave the metaphor there and hope that people would apply it for themselves.
Well, the book has a series of passages, I think, derived from Kerouac. They're lists, essentially, or at least they begin as lists, and Kerouac is the narrator, youth writer, the writer who exposes him to the wonder of freedom. Sort of two-thirds of the way into the book, the Kerouac passages bloom into a list of questions and ideas that one wakes up in the morning thinking that so-and-so is a hero, and by the next day is told that such-and-such is the hero instead. That we are no longer living, not only is it rival realities, it's incoherent juxtapositions.
That's
where
right.
The rules keep changing.
That's right. I mean, I think that's why That was, again, in a way, one of the most important discoveries for me of the use of this idea of alternative worlds. It's that it's not just an idea inside fiction. You know, that actually what we're asked to accept every day in the real world, in the world outside the book, is very radical redescriptions of things. You know, that one minute something exists, the next minute it doesn't. A country disappears, new countries appear, leaders vanish, roads change direction, frontiers move. You know, the actual reality is in a state of great flux.
Salman Rushdie, reading from The Ground Beneath Her Feet.
The world is irreconcilable. It doesn't add up. But if we cannot agree with ourselves that it does, we can't make judgments or choices. We can't live. When Ormus Kama saw his vision, he revealed himself to be a true prophet, and I say this as a dyed-in-the-wool unbeliever. I mean, he was genuinely ahead of his time. We've all caught up now. He isn't here to see them, but the contradictions in the real have become so glaring, so inescapable, that we're all learning to take them in our stride. We go to bed thinking, just a random example, that Mr. N.M. or Mr. G.A. is a notorious terrorist, and we wake up hailing him as the savior of his people. One day, the islanders inhabiting a particular cold, wet lump of godforsaken rock are vile devil worshippers swigging blood and sacrificing babies. The next day, it's as if nothing of the sort ever occurred. The leaders of whole countries vanish as if they never were. They're miraculously erased from the record. And then they pop up again as talk show hosts or pizza pluggers, and lo, they're back in the history books again. Certain illnesses sweep across large communities, and then we learn that no such illnesses ever existed. Men and women recover memories of having been sexually abused as children. Whoosh, no they don't. Their parents are reinstated as the most loving and laudable people you could imagine. Genocide occurs. No, it doesn't. Nuclear waste contaminates large swathes of entire continents, and we all learn words like half-life. But in a flash, all the contamination is gone. The sheep aren't ticking. You can happily eat your lamb chops. The maps are wrong. Frontiers snake across disputed territory, bending and cracking. A road no longer goes where it went yesterday. A lake vanishes. Mountains rise and fall. Well-known books acquire different endings. Color bursts out of black and white movies. Art is a hoax. Style is substance. The dead are embarrassing. There are no dead. You're a sports fan, but the rules are different every time you watch. You've got a job. No, you don't. That woman powdered the President's Johnson. In her dreams, she's a celebrated fantasist. You're a sex god. You're a sex pest. She's to die for. She's a slut. You don't have cancer. April Fool, yes you do. That good man in Nigeria is a murderer. That murderer in Algeria is a good man. That psycho killer is an American patriot. That American psycho is a patriot killer. And is that Pol Pot dying in the Angkoran jungle, or merely null not? These things are bad for you. Sex, high-rise buildings, chocolate, lack of exercise, dictatorship, racism. No, au contraire, celibacy damages the brain. High-rise buildings bring us closer to God. Tests show that a bar of chocolate a day significantly improves children's academic performance. Exercise kills. Tyranny is just a part of our culture, so I'll thank you to keep your cultural imperialist ideas off my fiefdom. And as for racism, let's not get all preachy about this. It's better out in the open than under some grubby carpet. That extremist is a moderate. That universal right is culturally specific. This circumcised woman is culturally happy. That Aboriginal whistle cockery is culturally barbaric. Pictures don't lie. This image has been faked. Free the press. Ban nosy journalists. The novel is dead. Honor is dead. God is dead. Arg, they're all alive and they're coming after us. That star is rising. No, she's falling. We dined at 9. We dined at 8. You were on time. No, you were late. East is west, up is down, yes is no, in is out, lies are truth, hate is love, and two makes five. That everything is for the best in this best of all possible worlds.
Salman Rushdie, reading from The Ground Beneath Her Feet. Ultimately, this book is about art, you know, and what art can do and how art is ordered. You say that there are no problems that art cannot solve technically. And this listing, this way of reality that reality has of opposing itself, is reality doing a favor to art.
Yes, indeed.
Making it possible for our books to be as wild and now wild as reality.
I think that's right. I think the interesting thing about the age we live in is that reality stopped being realistic. You know, that the world's now changing, transforming itself, exaggerating itself, becoming grotesque and implausible in so many ways that that the conventions of naturalistic fiction, you know, really seem quite inadequate to describe it, and in many ways seem like the implausible things. Whereas this stuff, you know, explosions, earthquakes, metamorphoses, dragons, that just seems like the newspapers.
This is a book of metamorphosis, and its heroes frequently go through metamorphic phases. In particular, they compare themselves to the god of the sea, who keeps changing form, and in fact, death is seen as a form of stasis, a point at which forms stop shifting. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, how does one construct a novel so embedded in the constant shiftinesses of its characters?
Well, I suppose it's partly, again, the answer is partly autobiographical in that that's what happened to me. You know, as we were saying, I grew up in one world with the expectation, if you like, not even the unexamined expectation of growing up to be one sort of person. And then because of the accidents of education and affinity, ended up making my life halfway around the planet, you know, and became another sort of person. And it's quite clear to me that a very small shift in the choices I made would have led to me being somebody quite other. And so I did go through a kind of membrane, if you like, a kind of transforming moment, or more than one, really. And so I've always had that sense of human personality as being mutable in that way, that we don't have to, and we often don't end up being the people we were supposed to be. You know, we somewhere along the line we jump tracks. You know, we go down the wrong road, or at least another road. And so it's always come quite naturally to me to make characters to whom things like that happen, you know, and who go through very radical changes.
We will go on in our next interview with Salman Rushdie to discuss the enormous subject of love in an age of cynicism. But for the meantime, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. My associate producer for today is Carly Eisman. The engineer is J.C. Swadek. Additional production assistance by Alan Howard. Development by Beverly Walker. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse, Pop Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.